Rusty Quill presents.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
You're listening to Haine by Motsi Dapu. Episode 39. Tanda.
Haine, I've really missed talking to you. I know it took me a while, but I'm helping my friends again. It got a bit dicey. They were attacked on two fronts, by two different elders. Honestly, I didn't do anything to help in the end. All I could do was help pick up the pieces. Some of it supernatural, and some of it emotional. You know Murphy? We're friends now, apparently. Family, I guess, would be more accurate. I didn't think I'd have that here. But it makes sense. We give each other a hard time. And I thought he hated me for our entire relationship, but it turns out he's just got baggage with a capital B, and now I'm somehow the de facto bridge between him and Ashvin, since he decided it would be a good idea to make a relationship decision after a life-and-death situation. Yeah. But, you know, I always trusted him, and that meant so much to me, having someone so solid to rely on. And he said he kind of trusts me, but not. I'm discovering things about me. About my body. My power. The thing you always seemed afraid to talk to me about. It was always a strange feeling, The way you believe that I could do so much, but the way you seemed afraid that I would. And now that I'm utilizing the tools you gave me, and the power you always seem to know I have, well, I'm afraid too. I don't know the extent of this power, and I don't know if I'm taking it too far. If I'm pushing the engine to full throttle and it's about to conk out or explode. But I can feel it. Like I feel too big for my skin sometimes. I wish you'd tell me what to do. I wish I could know what you know. But I don't. It's kind of nice, though, to talk to you like this. To be honest with you, because I never could be back in the Philippines. I was always too scared. You made me scared. And now I worry I'll never get the chance to ask you the questions I wanted to ask you. But that's why I do this. Just in case. I'm worried about Donner. I think he might be lying to me. No, actually, I know he's lying to me. I'm just not sure why. He went off on his own to the Toronto Necropolis, this enormous old cemetery in the middle of the city with some hundred-some-year-old graves. He went off alone because his mentor, who I just learned is named Dooley, was attacked by an elder, Richard Henry. He's only mentioned his mentor a few times, and he was always so secretive about it. Now I know it's because he wanted to protect him. Protect him. I spoke to him, to let him know about Donner's hospitalization. He asked me if Mikey found what he needed to find, which Murphy told me isn't his actual name, but a nickname he had from way back. He doesn't look like a Michael anyway, but...
Shut up.
I told him what Donner told me, but I confirmed that Donner destroyed whatever horror was in that grave, the William grave, and never found what he was looking for. A pocket watch. Jay, the journalist's pocket watch, said to hold incredible power, though he never mentioned where he got it from. Or if he did, it's not in the notes I read through. I've been able to record his notes, kasi. Notes that Evelyn was able to find with her very impressive navigation of Toronto's library archives. She'd do really well as an archivist, I think. Jay, this journalist I mentioned, he created the Book of Elders, cataloging all the elders he discovered in his time. He was active as early as the 1960s, all the way to the 1980s, but disappeared after leaving the book with his friend Elaine. I asked if he had anything of Jay's other than the Book of Elders, told him I could access sense memories through objects, feelings and flashes tied to the objects, the people who owned them, and even the people who kept them. The Book of Elders was void of feeling, absent of sense memory. I think, maybe, it was a spell or a good focus, like the pendant that protected Laura from George May, the foci Marianne made to combat the other elders. The Book of Elders stayed well hidden for so damn long, so whatever it was, it worked. Hid it away until Evelyn talked the last vestige of Elaine O'Donnell's soul into revealing its location. I wonder if the same spell applied for that pocket watch, because, well, I'm used to feeling sense memories brush against me. Everywhere I go. In places with so much history. Living in the world's densest city growing up certainly helped me get used to the feeling, The chaos just feels like home, and Toronto has much less of it, even if it's the closest thing to Manila I have here in Canada. So, ironically, when something hides in the absence of sense memory, I notice the absence. A yawning void in a sea of feeling. Silence in the noise. And I felt it. In Donner's hospital room. He must have found it. Or found something. But I don't understand why he wouldn't tell me. I want to believe he has a good reason. Or worse, he doesn't know, and something's latched on, but he didn't feel cursed, and he wasn't acting strange, so I don't think so. Other than the lying, but... I cast as many protections as I could on him without him noticing. I look him over, and other than the physical injuries, he seemed to be okay. I had to trust my senses on that, even if I now can't trust what he has to say. Great. Ugh, like I can talk, though. I lied to him, too. By omission, anyway. He thought I saved him. He thought I got him out of the William grave when he passed out. And I did call the ambulance, but... when I arrived at the necropolis, when I ran to the spot where the William grave ought to be, I saw him. Lying on the ground, unconscious. I could see blood shining in the meager light, and I saw... a man. At least, it looked like a man. He was almost like a shadow, in his long, black coat. But he seemed solid. He was leaning down, touching Donner's face. And I was so afraid of what he'd do, what he'd already done. So afraid I was too late. So I screamed Donner's name, and the man just disappeared. There one moment, gone the next. Like stepping into shadow. I thought maybe I saw his face, but I don't remember it. And I was so focused on Donner that I didn't notice it at the time, but when I went back, after I knew he was good and stable in the hospital, to confirm something back at the William grave, I couldn't see it. The entrance, the sign that was supposed to read William. I only knew where to look because I remember where Donner was, and the closest thing was this old stone box with a metal door, overgrown and overtaken by the hill and the trees. I was convinced it wouldn't open when I tried the door, but it did. And while I saw it sealed in stone, I put my hand against the stone and pushed through. It was hidden by some kind of spell. A powerful one, at that. I made my way down the steps that Donner did. I saw the markings, just like Donner had drawn them. Decided to record the ones Donner couldn't, so I could show them to CJ or Vanessa, our erstwhile elder allies. I hate to say it, but I think I'd rather spend weeks with CJ than a single day around Vanessa, but guess what I have to do tomorrow? I wandered the paths, the tunnels. I kept running to dead ends, but eventually, I found the strange control room that Donner described, and the corpse of the elder whose foci he destroyed. Two fine cufflinks, shattered on the ground. There was this old machine. It looked like it was made of gold, because it hadn't rusted over despite being caked in dust. It was like one of those old astronomical devices, Gemma's rings. It was nearby the wall that Donner described to me, with markings like the one he'd recorded at the bottom of the steps. I spent my time drawing the markings, confident that there was nothing else down there left to trouble me. I touched the body to see if there was any sort of sense memory there, even with the defunct foci. And I felt something strange. Not magic. Neither the vomit-inducing elder magic, nor any magic I've come to know, like Ashvin's. It was just a feeling. A human emotion. Shy joy. A velvet box. Expensive, but meaningful. Appreciation. Adoration. Affection. Arousal. Attention. Favor. Protection. Cold calculation. A rebuilt machine. Heartbreak. Bitter amusement. Half remembered. Cut off. Like I got an incomplete picture by design. Cut off. Like the missing head. Couldn't get much more than that. The whole tableau reminded me of the Gargantua, of what Vanessa told us about the place where Lori died. A place made specifically to open a door to the other side. A dangerous place, but one that couldn't work without enough of a power source. Something Vanessa and her husband have experience with. I went back up. Took me a bit. Stairs aren't exactly my friend, so you'll be glad to know that I've been putting more into cardio, what with all the running around and handling supernatural cases. I brought the symbols to CJ, who recognized them but couldn't read them. Forgot them, she said, after so long away from the Ordo's dealings. And that's how I met Dooley. CJ's looking after him, for Donner's sake. I know what I said about her, but CJ's good. Laura knows it better than anyone. They're dating, apparently. And she didn't have to do this for us, but she did, so she's good. She'll never hear from me, though. When Dooley gave me Jay's old notes, the ones that he left him before his disappearance, I felt such a tide of sense memory. Everything absent from the Book of Elders, present here. I felt love. So much love. Silent, but overflowing. Attraction. Known, but never admitted. Return, but never acknowledged. Regret. Sadness. Protectiveness. Determination. What I knew of Jay from his hidden notes, I could feel in the pages of the notebook Dooley had cared for so long, even with the singed edges from when Richard Henry went after him. And deeper in, I felt urgency, fear, caught like a mouse under the paw of a house cat. No time, they couldn't know. They had to be safe, he couldn't leave them without protection, but he couldn't know, or else. Then, familiarity. I turned to CJ, asked her what she knew, asked her to speak true. CJ looked, well, she looked guilty, afraid. But she told him, told us both, what she knew. That Jay fled Toronto. Left, not of his own free will, but under his own power. He had not been killed, or kidnapped, or taken. He left. I could see how much this news seemed to knock the wind out of Dooley. He sat in his chair, looking pensive as CJ went on. He was afraid of something, she said, but he would not say what or who. Whatever it was, it scared him well and truly, because in all the years she knew him, he was never cowed by elders or their power. He, after all, had his own, and he was hungry for answers. Whatever it was that chased him away, it spooked him. Badly. He sent her a letter before he left, with a sliver of the ribbon that he used to mark the Book of Elders. A sliver of ribbon from Marianne's Focus, a silk ribbon that she had once long ago gifted the Jay's grandparents, who met the philanthropist millionaire, Marianne Weeks, when they were young. In the letter, he left CJ instructions. He asked her to protect his loved ones, and she did. She cast protections on Dooley, on Elaine, on Jay's parents. She tried to find his little assistant in Tagalong, Peter, but she could not find him after Jay left. Maybe he left town. Or she lost track of him some other way. She didn't know. She watched them, and sent letters to a P.O. box in the USA, as per Jay's instruction, keeping them appraised of their lives. He didn't respond for a long time, until she sent news of his father's death. He asked her to attend his funeral, for he could not. It was the first time she realized he was even still alive. She kept sending the letters, fewer and fewer over time. Once, she did not correspond with him for months, and she received a letter containing only the words, "Please, keep writing." So she continued, told him of how Dooley spent time with his da, of Elaine's books, of the time she saw Dooley meet a young man in a khaki coat that she briefly thought was him, but turned out to be Dooley's detective mentee. Years of letters and only letters. Once she asked if he would ever come home, and he responded, simply, "He is not yet dead." And that was all that was said of the matter. Dooley asked CJ when she last sent a letter, and she said it had been a couple of months, but that she planned to send one about Richard Henry's attack, about her protections failing, but someone else's succeeding in keeping Dooley safe. Dooley asked her to tell him that he knew, that he wanted to see him, the absolute self-sacrificing fool. She agreed, and began writing, then and there. I asked her to include something as well. A little something for me, just a single question. I didn't want to step on Dooley's toes, and it was a miracle he was still upright after that gut punch of a revelation. I asked her to include the question, B or RH, in the postscript. "I don't even know if he's still alive," she said. "The last time he responded was a year ago. But if anything gets him to respond, it'll be this." Dooley made it clear that he was unhappy she kept this from him, but thanked her anyway. I took his hand when I saw it shaking and embraced him. He looked grateful for it, but I couldn't blame him for how unsteady he was. I helped him to the guest room where he fell asleep, tired from the day. When we were alone, I asked CJ if she helped Jay write the Book of Elders. She said, "Yes, in part." "He interviewed me," she said, "on the elders he somehow already knew about, in the very least by name or by record of encounter." The only reason she agreed to help him was that he was already so knowledgeable, and of course, like Laura, the fact that he carried a good focus from her lost lover Marianne moved her to engage with the world she'd washed her hands of. "There were many answers I provided," she said, "but I was not the only one. I know he had some sort of relationship with Clifford Bolden, and had encountered things before, but there were things he knew that he had no way of knowing, things that even I did not know. He had another friend and patron, an elder apart from me, and I do not know who. I did not dare ask, for fear of being known. It was in that moment that I sighed, looked CJ in the eyes, and told her what I learned from Jay's Book of Elders, which she had never herself read. Somehow, some way, Jay knew the fate of elders even CJ did not. Most notably, Jay knew the fate of their founder, first leader, and powerful ally, William C. Savard. Richard Milton Henry. Description: a white, dark-haired man in his mid-30s, brown eyes, often dresses in simple but fine clothes, wears fine cufflinks. Described as unassuming. Known to be detail-oriented, reserved, efficient, and effective. Spells created. Spectral hand slash eye slash ear. The ability to manifest an extra sense through magic. Trigger spell. The ability to time a spell's release or activate a spell if or when certain conditions are met. Used in the development of Savard's original foci. Tracking spell. The ability to track someone's location when in possession of a charmed object. Distant communication. The ability to send messages from afar without alerting others. Messages would appear on blank pieces of paper nearest to the receiver when written by the sender. Record keeping. Seemingly developed to keep better track of necessary records. The Benefactor. Name unknown. Description. Physical description unknown. Those who have encountered him remember fine clothes and often fine cufflinks, but due to a powerful spell, have no memory of his face or name. Those who remember him from the Ordo remember simple clothes of middling quality. Known to be brilliant, charismatic, intelligent, and shrewd. Developed more spells than any other member of the Ordo, barring Marianne Weeks. He was also very adept at adopting and perfecting the spells of others, and had mastered the signature spells developed by other members, such as Bartolotti's shadow-stepping spell, or Marianne Weeks's protection spells. Spells created. Soul partition. A spell used to divide one's soul to reside in foci, so that one might be functionally immortal, even if one is killed. Unknown memory spell. Mass? Question mark. This spell is unverified, based only on the effect of the benefactor's anonymity. It seems to immediately wipe anyone's memory of the benefactor's face or name, even if they will largely remember encounters with him, even including his clothing. Nobody is able to describe his appearance, voice, or any other physical traits. Silent casting. The ability to cast spells silently, without the use of trigger phrases or words, or physical movements. Concealment spell. The ability to be present in the space without being noticed. Rather than simple invisibility, it also allows the caster to be unheard and unnoticed, short of being touched directly. Glamour. A spell that the benefactor himself did not develop, but perfected or streamlined. The ability to change one's perception of one's appearance. Illusion spell, limited. A spell that the benefactor did not develop but perfected or streamlined. The ability to cast an illusion that might trick the naked eye. The clearer the image in the caster's mind, the more convincing the illusion. Concussive spell. The ability to push a full-grown human being back with a powerful concussive blast. Mirror combustion spell. Used on Giovanni Grigori, Jean-Paul Renard, and George Langford during their attempted coup. This spell turns magical energies back in the form of an unstable explosion, often disintegrating living tissue in the process. Used in tandem by the benefactor, Giuliano Bartolotti, and William C. Savard. Manifestation, limited. The ability to manifest non-living objects for a short period of time. Individual protection spell. Developed in tandem with Marianne Weeks, an invisible barrier which protects from magical and, to a lesser extent, physical attacks. Barrier protection spell. Developed in tandem with Marianne Weeks, a visible barrier of larger size and limited scope, protecting as many people as are between the barrier and the source of harm. More effective against physical attacks if positioned correctly. Transportation spell. the ability to transport physical objects to other locations. The larger the object, the more power required. Location must already be known to the caster. Limited mind reading? Unverified, based on descriptions of the benefactor's uncanny ability to know what others are thinking. May not be a spell at all, but a quirk of his. Ugh, this is a long list. I'm gonna come back to it, but... Ah, here we go. In the time of Savard, he did not have the reputation he does now. In the time of Savard, he was known as one of the Inner Circle, and a brilliant developer of spells. He was often underestimated despite this, due to what my friend describes as a mismatched, well-meaning nature. It was not until the coup, enacted by Grigori, Renard, and Langford, that his ability to engage in cold-blooded murder came to light, and he seemed largely unaffected by his role in disintegrating these men with a snap of his fingers. Strangely, my friend said, though they could not remember the benefactor's features, they could very clearly remember the image of a young man with blood splattered across his face, a look of satisfaction crossing his features, as his fellow, Richard Henry, handed him a kerchief to wipe himself with. The benefactor held a prominent position under Savard, but was otherwise more interested in the science and mastery of magic than he was in the influence and privilege that it might bring to him. He believed, well and truly, in Savard's vision for a better world, and believed that magic would be the way to achieve it. He was an idealist, a kindly soul, a benefactor, even long before he was given that epithet, prone to assisting Marianne Weeks in her charitable endeavors. Savard admired his idealism, but worried that he was too soft to do what must be done to achieve a better world. Between him and Marianne, Savard favored Marianne as his successor, believing her to be more iron-willed and able to carry out his will. It was only after the coup that Savard began to believe the benefactor capable of being his successor, and revealed to him his ultimate plan for the city of Toronto, and the goal that the Ordo was built to accomplish. It was a goal that he revealed only to the benefactor, Richard Henry, and Marianne Weeks. After Savard's abdication and disappearance, and a power vacuum was formed, many elders began infighting, splitting into factions and forming agreements, or targeting one another in pursuit of power. After some years, it was the benefactor who gained the reputation for being the most powerful of these, and many others allied with him out of fear. He became known as much a bane of elders as he was their rising leader. His rise to power only disrupted when the puppet master entered the playing field. It seemed, at first, that he wished to carry on Savard's vision. His power before his war with the puppet master was not significantly greater than that of his fellows, but many feared him for his knowledge of spells that they did not have, or ones they knew but had less proficiency in. The benefactor's knowledge, his shrewdness, his calculating wit, were the weapons with which he fought and clawed his way to the top. A strange outcome for someone remembered as being so very good-natured. Nowadays, the benefactor is better known for how much the elders fear him. They see him as an enemy, even those who call him ally. He has punished many an elder for violating some unspoken agreement, for acting beyond Savard's old rules, most notably, for tormenting and killing ordinary human beings to gather power, instead of accepting the random chance of hundreds of foci still being triggered to this day. Clifford Bolden feared him, even when he saw him as a steadfast ally. The fear was that any small misstep might turn the benefactor against him, though it is unclear if this is a charitable view of the benefactor as a man, or one colored by Bolden's fear. My friend said that the benefactor's mind is not known to them any more, for it has been long since they and the benefactor have spoken. But my friend's greatest fear, it seems, is what a man might do when he holds such immense power and believes himself Good. William Cornelius Savard, Sr. Description: a white, gray-haired man in his early 50s, with clean, well-kept facial hair. Pale skin, cold blue eyes. Of great stature, broadened shoulders, standing at above 6 feet. Wore simple but fine clothing, with a silver ring embossed with his family crest, a stylized S with some embellishments. Sometimes wore fine cufflinks with the same symbol. Spells created. Conflagration, a powerful fire spell that Savard was best known for. Savard's fires could burn through conditions and elements that would kill most fires, and seemed to be able to burn endlessly for as long as Savard willed it, and as long as he had the power source. His fire was unnatural, for it could respond to his will, and he used it to make some of his enemies disappear, or to hide evidence. He used it to destroy the bodies of those who attempted a coup, and was so adept in his use of this spell that he gained his title as Elder of Fire. Clockwork Brain. Savard was an adept hand at clockwork machinery, a passion of his wife's that he adopted long ago. Even as rich as he was, it was said that his presents to his family were often handmade. He once presented his son with a clockwork bird in a cage that sang various nursery rhymes, his favorite being the song Billy Boy. Similar to the recent invention of the personal computer, these clockwork creations seemed to exhibit extensive stores of human knowledge and a certain amount of intelligence that seemed uncannily human-like. Savard also created a few clockwork dolls and even a small-scale automaton, capable of human speech. Creation of the Foci. Savard discovered the way by which one could harness the power of fear death, the strong emotions tied to one's passing into the afterlife, by supernatural means, in order to perform powerful magic. Subspells: miasma, infusion, frightful illusion, entrapment, life extension, trigger spell, tracking spell, dissemination spell. Miasma. The ability to enclose someone in a powerful magic space which is imperceptible to those outside the space. Within the space, one may find oneself lost in a labyrinth or turned into dead ends. It is unknown whether the space within the miasma is infinite or recycled, but it is known that a miasma is able to create or manifest spaces larger than that of its real-world scope. There is also often a chronal element, as time passes differently within a miasma. It is not impossible to escape this space. However, fear and panic make it hold on to and confuse its victims more effectively. Infusion. The ability to infuse objects with magical properties, such as the infusion of a mix of magical properties into foci, as well as the infusion of powerful magic into an object of power. Frightful illusion. Similar to an illusion spell, but with a more sinister element, frightful illusion allows its victim to see their worst or most immediate fears. In some cases, one might see a fear that has plagued one for a long time, while in others, one might perceive a fear as influenced by the location, miasma, the manifested phantasm that is tied to the space, or the elder who is present, or to whom the original focus belongs. Entrapment. A spell used to entrap power in an object, such as a focus. The potent power collected from a fear death can often be entrapped in the same object triggered to cause it. Life extension. Functional immortality, but not invulnerability. Life extension takes the power generated by fear death and translates it into life force, additional years a caster might live. It also makes those receiving said life force resistant or entirely immune to illness and physical maladies. This spell cannot reverse age or heal wounds received before its implementation. Trigger spell, tracking spell, developed by Richard Henry, used to enable the triggering of a focus in the presence of strong emotional bursts, moments of fear, or as a result of weakness in the veil, in the general vicinity of a focus, such as sights of mass death or tragedy. Dissemination spell. A spell enabling the fair distribution of life extension. Savard created all original foci at the same time in the presence of all members of the original Ordo, so that each of them may receive an equal amount of life force and magic from every activated focus. William Cornelius Savard Sr. was the leader and founder of the Ordo. Historically known for his contributions to Toronto's Golden Age of Construction and Industry. He was known as a fair-minded, brilliant man, well-regarded by his peers and even high-ranking officials and nobility residing in Ontario at the time. Of his reputation, the only oddity, which some regarded as a stain, was his interest in the occult. His many connections wished to retain his friendship, due to his well-managed network of builders and out-of-city resources, a testament to the skill of his assistant, Richard Henry. He was also unique in his relationship with the nouveau riche, particularly that of black hotel tycoon Robert James Weeks, who himself established large-scale transportation within the ever-growing city center. Earlier in life, Savard married a woman named Elizabeth Brown, and they had one child, William Savard Jr. Though deeply invested in his work, Savard loved his wife dearly, and it is said he wished to make the world a better place for his young son to live in. His wife died of illness when young William was still a child, and this inspired Savard's study of the supernatural. It is said that his close friendship with the Weeks family was due to their kindness in asking after his family when her death took place during their first business transactions. Robert James spoke of his own wife's passing, and offered the company of his elder daughter and younger son to ease the younger William's loneliness. It is said that Marianne, her brother, John Isaac, and the young Savard heir were inseparable friends in youth. In adulthood, Marianne was active as her father's assistant and eventual representative, but John Isaac and William Jr. remained close friends. When William Sr. eventually established the Ordo Fratrum Manus Passae, or the Fraternal Order of the Outstretched Hand, a group ostensibly dedicated to the betterment of society in the face of many social ills plaguing the territory, he invited Marianne to his inner circle. Marianne, a known philanthropist, was taken in by Savard's drive and his promises of a better world for everyone. It was only later, when Savard's nature crystallized, that she began her own quiet rebellion. Savard was a good leader, and believed himself a good, upright man of integrity. And in many ways, he was. But in his mind, there was a very rigid view of what a good man ought to be, and what a good person ought to be, and he became more and more embittered by the social ills he saw filling the ramshackle houses surrounding what would eventually become downtown Toronto. Those who engage in debauchery, rather than contribute to society. Those drunkards and waifs and thieves and cutthroats, ladies of the night and criminal elements, the godless lot for whom Toronto the Good was something to exploit. In matters of race, he had a charitable, even admirable view of those who worked hard to contribute to society. The black workers excluded from unions, the immigrants who helped build the roads and tracks, and the slowly forming underground. Those, in his mind, were those worthy of the better world he dreamed of. But in the end, Savard believed, more than anything, that those who did not contribute to building this new world needed to be eradicated. Of his most trusted, only Marianne seemed uncertain, though she shared his larger view. She knew of the dangers of the ills of man. She knew what they were capable of, and the darkness that could reside within. But she also knew that circumstance was a powerful arbiter of one's fate, and the outside observer could not know what was choice and what was circumstance. But then came a time of unrest. The Great Depression, in which the lively, hardy years that the Ordo grew, disappeared with economic decline. Crime and poverty were more rampant than ever, and Savard became convinced that time was running out for his new, better world. In those years, Don Isaac Weeks passed away, and Marianne withdrew. Savard began enacting his plans in secret, building a great project beneath the earth, its pause only coming when Marianne herself passed away, and sent the Ordo into a fit of unrest, uncertain of what could have killed such a wise and powerful elder as she. It was, to Savard, a tragedy, but perfect timing for his plans to finally bear fruit. With his great fire, he burned down the ward, the part of the city that, in Savard's view, represented everything wrong with the world. A pit of disease, both of the body and the soul. 200 dead in one night. It would empower his great machine, which my friend called the Godhead. It was after this that Savard abdicated, and after some days, vanished. He never activated his great machine. My friend would not, or could not, say more of the matter. And that was the end of their great leader, Savard, disappeared into the night. In my research, I uncovered what may have been the reason for Savard's disappearance. His household was interviewed after months without word. First, they begged off, asking for privacy after an unexpected illness. And eventually, the household reported the death of young William Savard, the only direct heir to the Savard legacy. Later papers seemed to question the whereabouts of Savard Sr., though speculation leaned toward the man traveling away from the city to grieve in peace, and nothing was said of the matter after that. His estate was eventually handed over to the city after many years. His name can still be found in some historical plaques around the city, or carved into the stone structures he built or funded. As for the elders, Savard's disappearance sparked the first moves toward civil war between members, and the formation of factions. It is my understanding that Vanessa Smythe, a lower-ranking member, was able to collect Savard's notes and ally with one of his inner circle, Juliano Bartolotti. Most notably, Savard's assistant of many years, Richard Henry, allied with the benefactor, who was, in the eyes of many, Savard's great successor, and insisted that his allies carry on Savard's will. As for Savard himself, well, he might as well have died the night that his only son passed away. And all that was left was... a page was ripped out. I think... Oh yeah, Michael. It's fine, though. I know where the story goes from there. The Vagrant. Description. A white, gray-haired man in his early 50s, with a thick, unkempt beard. Pale skin, cold blue eyes under a heavy brow. Of great stature, broad in shoulder, standing at above 6 feet when standing at full height, though he is often slouching. Wearing old, worn, gray and brown clothing. Known to some as the Angel of Winter. Known to others simply as the Old Man of Toronto. He is known to wander the streets as any other vagrant, asking for alms and for food. What makes him unique is that, during the harsh winter months, he often appears to light a fire near encampments and underneath bridges. It is said that his fire does not go out, no matter how cold or windy it is, and some have even claimed that his fire does not harm them, no matter how closely they touch it. Nobody knows how to get in touch with this man, or how to track him down. And though he often visits the same spots, he's rarely seen by those who wish to encounter him. Some say he appears when he is most needed, in the dark and the cold. One even claimed to know his name, though they only ever called him Neil. Another said they saw him burn down a house, and they did not know if there were people in there, sleeping that night. And it seems that all there was to unite these descriptions was fire.
Hello? Vanessa? Yeah, I'm coming over tomorrow. To prepare for the meeting. Yes, I'll give you the full rundown of the situation when I come over. He's in the hospital, thanks to your friend. We'll talk more tomorrow. Good night.
You're listening to Hainai by Motsi Dapul.
Hi everyone, it's Motsi. The U.S. recently vetoed acknowledging a Palestinian state in the UN. And currently, Columbia University students are engaging in massive protests to divest all funds from corporations profiting off Israel's apartheid and genocide of Palestine. Over 100 were arrested and tried for trespassing, despite being students who resided in campus housing. As I said before, I continue the segment to keep a timeline of Israel and the USA's crimes of genocide and complicity. They're doing everything they can to ensure Israel does not face justice for its crimes despite their murder of over 33,000 civilians, including more than 13,000 children, with dozens upon hundreds still being killed every day even now. We must continue to support any and all efforts to end Israel's apartheid and genocide and have them answer for their war crimes. But those who cannot take part in protests such as these can still provide aid to Palestinians in dire need. eSIMS for Gaza is continuously allowing people to stay connected and online. They need more eSIMS, please consider making them a regular donation. And Care for Gaza continues to provide aid from within Gaza, delivering food to families. The Palestine Children's Relief Fund, or PCRF, is also still active in Gaza, providing medical aid and delivering vegetables to alleviate hunger. All of these operate within Gaza, or are able to provide direct aid within Gaza. For everyone fighting for the people of Palestine, thank you. We stand with you and hope you stay safe. May we all see a free, independent Palestinian state within our lifetime. Thank you. We love you. Kaleya and Paras Palestina. Ingat.
Crimes of the Marcuses. Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr. and his running mate, Sara Duterte, campaigned for presidency and vice presidency, respectively, under the tandem Uniteam. Not even 2 years into their term, and it seems the duo are anything but united. Tensions between the Marcos and Duterte dynasties seem to have started last January. At a rally in Davao City, former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte called the current president Bongbong Marcos a drug addict. Duterte's son, Davao City Mayor Sebastian Basta Duterte, while asking for Bongbong to resign, called him lazy and lacking in compassion. Marcos's sister, Senator Aimee Marcos, who has been trying to forge an alliance with the Duterte family, attempted damage control. She claimed Basta had apologized to her only to be strongly rebuked by Basta himself, who asserted he did not apologize for his statements and he stands by them. Bongbong shrugged off accusations against him by claiming that Duterte must have been high on fentanyl when he made the speech. In a recent interview, First Lady Liza Marcos expressed her disdain with the rally and VP Sara Duterte's attendance. "You went to a rally, then your president gets called a drug addict, and you're going to laugh? Is that right?" she asked, then added, for good measure, "Even Lenny Robredo never did that." referring to Marcos's strongest opposition during the 2022 presidential race. A video also recently surfaced showing the First Lady publicly snubbing the Vice President during the Marcos's family departure ceremony for a foreign mission on January 29, 2024. This just marks the beginning of the Marcos Duterte word war. Just last week, Rodrigo referred to Bongbong as a crybaby for seeking U.S. aid. Bongbong has been urged to rethink the Vice President's appointment as educational chief, and whether he should continue having a Vice President who constantly undermines him. While it is extremely entertaining to watch two fascist families implode, it is equally frustrating to see the level of immaturity our leaders hold themselves to while they run the country to the ground. It's a mockery of the very real crisis they should be addressing instead. Rising inflation and poverty, the devastating heat, the extreme traffic situation. Filipinos deserve leaders who take their public service more seriously. Not this current dystopian reality show we seem to have found ourselves in.
Hey everyone, this is Reg Heli, co-creator and co-producer of Hainai. Hainai is a podcast produced by Motsi Dapol, Yoy Halago, Alisa Jimenez, and me, and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 4.0 International License. This episode was co-produced by Jesse Goodsell and written and directed by Motsi Dapol, who plays the role of Mary Datuin. If you'd like to chat with other listeners when this episode goes live, we do a live premiere every other Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time or Toronto Time on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/HainaiPod. To help support the production of Hainai, you can subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/HainaiPod. You'll get to be part of our early access program where we release episodes 3 days earlier on Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also get bonus video, audio, art, and so much more. Speaking of Patreon, we'd love to give a shout out to the following patrons for all their amazing support. Jesse Goodsell, Danny, Diana Cos, Emma Halig, Evie Smith, Jaden, Madeline Hicks, Malaya Light, Megan, Melissa, Pablo Neurotic, and Victoria Goodwin. If you can't subscribe monthly, you also have the option to buy us a milk tea on Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/HainaiPod. That's ko-fi.com/HainaiPod. Our ad-free Hainai album, which has our official music and full episodes from Act 1 and 2, is also available in both Patreon and the Ko-fi store. Check out our website, hainaipod.com, for more information. And for more news and updates, don't forget to follow us on our blog, hainaipod.tumblr.com, as well as our socials, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, at hainaipod. That's HINAYPOD. Hainai is available on Acast and wherever you listen to podcasts. We hope you enjoy our Act 3 episodes, and as always, thank you, we love you, and hanggang sa muli.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.